and welcome to the reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette and Fort Dodge Messenger for Tuesday, December 5th, 2023. I'm your reader, Mary Frances, and you're listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped. We'll start with the Globe Gazette. On the front page, we have a giant photo taking up the majority of the page, and the headline is Home for Christmas, and it shows a number of young men and women in army fatigues standing at attention. And the caption reads, Iowa Army National Guard soldiers of the 100 or the 1133rd Transportation Company stand at attention as they sing the Army song at their welcome home ceremony Saturday at the Waterloo Convention Center in Waterloo. The company had been deployed to Poland for 10 months in support of Operation European Assure, Deter, and Reinforce. And then the other story on the front page, remote learning works for some, hampers others. So we'll start with the story that accompanies the big photo of our servicemen and women. And it says 1133rd Transportation Company welcomed home at Waterloo Ceremony. This is from Angela Sturm McLaughlin of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier. Dateline Waterloo. Family and friends gathered Saturday to formally welcome home approximately 160 members of the Mason City-based 1133rd Transportation Company at the Waterloo Convention Center. The Iowa National Guard soldiers, some of whom have been back in Iowa since August, gathered for a ceremony marking nearly a year's deployment to Poland as part of Operation European Assure, Deter, and Reinforce. Families already have had some time to catch up with the soldiers they love. Right off the start, it was weird being back. Before I left, we had just had a baby, and he was 3 weeks old, said Specialist Jason Rahe, that's R-A-H-E, of Mason City. Coming back and seeing him almost 10 months old was a big change. Haley Rahe expressed her happiness with having her husband home. She said the services the National Guard provides for families of the deployed can be a lifeline. Quote, it's been tough, but I'm glad to have him home. We have four kids and we were blessed. They really supported us while Jason was gone. That was huge for us, she said. After all of the excitement, Jason Rahe is ready for a low-key holiday season. We had our big vacation as a family last weekend in the Wisconsin Dells. It was fun. We met my brother and his three boys there. We had a fun getaway, he said. Ray's son Parker has some ideas on how he and his dad can spend time together. I like that he's able to play catch with me and coach sports, Parker said. One soldier spoke for the entire company in expressing his gratitude to be back home. It's amazing to be home, said Sergeant Andrew O'Day of Oskaloosa. Being around family and friends, nothing compares to being in a foreign country for 10 months and then returning home to the United States of America. Home means a lot of things. It's amazing. U.S. Senator Chuck Grassley was in attendance, but did not address the gathering. He expressed his thanks before the event. Quote, I've gone both when they leave Iowa and when they come home. It's always more enjoyable when they come home. The number one responsibility of the federal government is national defense. We have a responsibility to provide you with what you need, Grassley said. Governor Kim Reynolds sent well wishes via a recorded message. Quote, as governor, I consider these homecomings one of the greatest privileges that I get to share with Iowans, the message said, and it continues, the joyful reunions of family and friends are powerful to witness and important reminders that while you supported your nation overseas, your loved ones served here at home. Next article from the front page, remote learning works for some, hampers other. This is from Alexander Schmidt of the Globe Gazette. And it shows a photo of a room with someone talking on a large screen and about six people seated at tables watching the screen. And the caption is, the Mason City School Board hears from Savannah Schultz, whose grades have improved since being able to attend school remotely at the Mason City Virtual Academy. If one thing is becoming clear as students and educators continue to learn lessons about virtual learning, it's the need to look at what best serves the individual student's needs. If the uncertain early days of the pandemic, or in the uncertain early days of the pandemic, learning from home was deemed a necessity. For some students, it's the ace in the hole. For others, it may only appear that way. State performance profiles from the Department of Education show that the Mason City Virtual Academy dropped in performance compared to last year in all categories, scoring 39.7 out of 100, targeting the Virtual Academy as a priority. The state's average score is 54.81. Currently, there are 92 7th through 12th grade students enrolled at the Mason City Virtual Academy. 33 are in their senior year, 13 are open enrollments from other districts, and 12 receive special education services or have individualized education plans. Mason City Virtual Academy was established in August of 2021 during the COVID-19 emergency through ESSER funds, and it allows students to continue learning virtually instead of going to a physical classroom. Students use Chromebooks and Google-based technology for their assignments. Teachers use Google Classroom as the web-based platform, which enables them to create an online classroom area in which they can manage all the documents that their students need. Documents are stored on Google Drive and edited in its apps such as Google Docs and Sheets. As the pandemic-related funding slowly expired, the board in April 2023 approved to restructure Mason City Virtual Academy to now fit under the Alternative Education Program and to eliminate virtual learning for K-6, making in-person learning the only option for elementary students. Quote, engagement of some students has been difficult. Virtual Academy has not been a good fit for a few students below 7th grade. Superintendent Pat Hamilton said that was his quote. He cited data that shows with only 11 such students enrolled, one teacher retirement, and the program's cost exceeding revenue, returning them to in-person learning was, quote, best for all students K-6. Moving the Virtual Academy to alternative learning, Hamilton added, made sense because many of the students enrolled virtually are utilizing individualized instruction plans and credit recovery, and, quote, things that the alternative coordinators are already equipped to handle, unquote. According to research compiled by the Hechinger Report, which covers inequality and innovation in education, studies show that lost in-person classroom time reduces social and emotional skills, hinders academic progress, and can decrease a student's likelihood of graduating, and consequently, lower levels of education that can lead to lower employment and financial prospects in adulthood. However, research compiled by the American Psychological Association shows that the focus on mental health in schools, brought on in part by addressing their social anxiety in a classroom setting, has the potential to improve students' well-being in profound ways, starting with helping them recover from the pandemic's effects. The prospect of replacing teachers and chalkboards with laptops and Zoom calls is a dilemma older than the pandemic. In fact, it's as old as the technology itself. Research in childhood development shows that students who have more choices about their materials and activities are more motivated, which translates to increased learning and academic success, according to psychology researcher Alan Wigfield. In Stephen P. Becker and Rosanna Bro's research, parents of students with ADHD, particularly those with a 504 planned and an IEP, reported greater difficulties with remote learning. But some students with special learning needs, including those with IEPs and 504 plans, thrived in an at-home learning environment. Jacqueline Frels is currently a senior at Mason City High and attended the Virtual Academy for a year and a half. Quote, part of the reason for attending virtually was I recently had surgery on my foot, she said, but I also had lots of anxiety with doing presentations and stuff like that. Overall, it only took me a couple of hours to get my schoolwork done, as opposed to the full 8 hours, she said. But math, I struggled with on my own, she admits. If I needed help, it was sometimes kind of hard to get a hold of teachers in time. Frels decided to return to in-person learning her senior year to rekindle the missed relationships she had with her classmates. I thought, it's my senior year. I might as well go back. And I do like being back. I get to socialize more, and that just makes school a little less depressing. Julie Ulve, that's U-L-V-E, coordinator of the Virtual Academy, told the Mason City School Board that she has seen students flourish in her 4 years assisting with the rollout of the program. Quote, "We strive to make a positive culture and climate to make students feel comfortable. Every student is unique, and we are flexible in working with them," she said. In a video shared at the board meeting, one such student, Savannah Schultz, said that before her parents agreed to virtual learning, she would wake up every Monday through Friday crying and begging my parents not to take me to school that day, unquote. Actually, she continues here, "Just let me homeschool," she pleaded. "I physically could not stomach the idea of walking through the doors and sitting through an 8-hour day with the kids around me," unquote. "I never felt like I stood a chance. School was so lonely. No matter how hard I tried to make friends, no free friends seemed to be had, so I quit trying. Like most people, I cannot work in an environment where I'm uncomfortable." Now she's found a way to go to school. Now that she's found a way to go to school that works for her, Schultz said her grades are improved and she's on track to graduate in 2024. Quote, "My stress and anxiety towards school has definitely subsided. I like doing schoolwork now, which is something I never thought I'd say. I'm looking forward to graduating this spring, and I'm forever grateful to the Mason City Virtual Academy for being there and continuing to be there is the only schooling option today that makes me feel comfortable." Our next story, the Iowa Works Mason City office at 600 Pierce, South Pierce Avenue hosts weekly hiring events Tuesday in the Job Center to connect job-ready candidates with area employers who are hiring. Employers from the area participate, and all interested applicants are encouraged to attend. Quote, "There's never been a greater time to re-enter the workforce, and these weekly hiring events will help showcase the wide variety of positions available in our area," said Sarah Cook, business engagement consultants for Iowa Workforce Development within the Iowa Works Mason City Center. "Our weekly hiring events are often the first step to re-employment or even new careers in high-demand fields. Iowa Works stands ready to help any job seeker find the connection they need to get started," she said. Tuesday's event features from 1 to 3 p.m. include the United States Postal Service and the Jeremy Rogsted State Farm Insurance Company. You can learn more about these events at Iowa Works, and you can contact them at 641-422-1524. Our next story, MCHS Senior Shipman named Noon Rotary Student of the Month. And it shows a photo of a smiling young man in a purple suit, black shirt and tie. He's got blonde hair and a big smile. And the copy reads, "Alexander Shipman is a senior at Mason City High School. He was selected as the Noon Rotary Club's Student of the Month for December. He's the son of Scott and Tracy Shipman. I'm involved in a number of activities both inside and outside of school. I'm a senior drum major and band president. I'm a member of the MCHS Concert Choir, and I made the All-State Choir this year as a tenor. I'm the officer at large and chairman of the Pep Assembly Committee in the Student Senate, as well as a member of the National Honor Society. I'm also part of the Speech Club, Mock Trial Team, and Model UN. Outside of school, I've been attending Stebbins Children's Theater for the past 10 years. I most recently portrayed the villainous Bill Sykes in the musical Oliver and the comedic Marcellus Washburn in The Music Man. December 6th, Cinderella will be opening, in which I play the role of Prince Charming. When I'm not busy, I enjoy spending time with friends. I try to watch my Chicago Bears attempt at playing competent football. Next year, I plan to attend the University of Iowa. There, I will be following the pre-law path to fulfill my aspirations of becoming a lawyer. I hope to continue in student leadership, music, and theater while in college." And he does look kind of like a Prince Charming in his photo. Next story, Cerro Gordo County asks for landowner assistance in snow control. This is from Natty Harnick. "There's nothing quite like a peaceful drift of snowflakes on a winter's evening. That is, until it's time to move the snow for work in the morning. While there's no foolproof method of wind and snow control, properly designed and maintained snow fences can reduce problem areas. With the help of rural landowners, Cerro Gordo County can make roads much safer this winter and give landowners a chance to make a little extra money by participating in the county's snow fence program. The county uses three types of fencing. A structural fence can be temporary or permanent and takes up little space. Standing cornrows are excellent and also provide a home for wildlife, and landowners can be compensated. A living snow fence can be created through the State Conservation Reserve Program. The CRP can pay out for up to 15 years, and it's basically maintenance-free. Mary Arndt, that's A-R-N-D-T, assistant to the county engineer, said the program is just taking off. We've opened up an opportunity for landowners to use a number of types of snow fencing. There are a few different ways to do it, from bales along the roadway to leaving a standing corn fence, she said. The program is designed to keep rural roads from drifting over during heavy snowstorms. Temporary snow blocking, such as plastic or wooden fencing, can be done yet this year, whereas the standing corn and CRP programs must be planned in advance beginning in the spring. Snow fencing keeps roads from drifting heavily. According to the Strategic Highway Research Program, quote, national research has found that it costs 100 times more to plow the snow than to trap it with a snow fence. Each method has its own requirements, but a good rule of thumb is that the setback should be 35 times the height of the fence. Standing corn rows are generally set back 210 feet from the roadway. When it comes to rural travel, the benefits of snow fencing are immeasurable. Not only does it keep blowing snow off of roads, cut costs for plow operators, it reduces erosion and can provide habitat for wildlife. By keeping the roads clear, accidents are reduced, as well as damage to roadways from freeze and thaw effects. Cerro Gordo County is not actively placing plastic snow fencing on landowners' property, although that is a viable option for property owners who would like to participate this season. There is no compensation for placing your own plastic fencing. If landowners would like to participate with compensation this season, they can place hay bales or silage bags at the county's direction to receive $1 per foot of roadway affected. We haven't had any participants for the standing corn program yet, Arndt said. We will, of course, be contacting a few owners where the drifting is bad to use pushed-up snow in their fields. Pushed-up snow is another temporary option in which county employees will use a maintainer to create a wall of snow to prevent further drifting. Once the ground is fully frozen, crews can then use the equipment to create the snow walls. There's still time to get connected to the Cerro Gordo's Engineering and Secondary Roads Department to place a temporary structural fence or set bales or silage bags for the winter. There are requirements to participate. Snow fence must be placed an appropriate distance from the roadway in order to be the most effective. If you want to learn more, there's a phone number here, and it is 641-424-9037. And turning to the opinion page in the Globe Gazette, the political cartoon shows two frames. On the left is option A, on the right is option B. Both show a picture of the United States Capitol dome. So option A on the left, Russia invades Ukraine, and there's a thought bubble coming out of the Capitol that says, send your money. Option B on the right, Russia wins and invades NATO, and the thought bubble with this one says, send your sons. And then there are no local opinions in the Globe Gazette today. Let's see. I'll read the one that's closest to our area from the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. Ireland shows fallacy of guns don't kill trope. The knife attack that wounded an adult and three children in Dublin recently and the subsequent anti-migrant rioting there demonstrated the ways in which the U.S. and Ireland are part of the same chilling trajectory of political violence and intolerance that is racking so much of the world today. as well as the one big way in which America remains a tragic outlier from other advanced nations. Driven by unconfirmed rumors that a knife-wielding assailant outside a Dublin school was an Algerian immigrant, some 500 rioters rampaged through the capital city, smashing windows and burning police cars, some holding Irish Lives Matter signs. America is, sadly, not alone these days, regarding the hateful xenophobia of many on the political right. But the attack that started it all was notably different from what Americans are used to, and that there was, initially at least, no death toll. That could yet change. A 5-year-old girl was in critical condition with stab wounds. Still, it doesn't discount the horror to note that when sociopaths go on attempted murder sprees in gun-happy America, they're generally far more successful than their counterparts in other advanced nations. That's because, unlike in Ireland and the rest of the advanced world, it's easy for practically anyone in America to land their hands on a semi-automatic firearm. The gun lobby and its Republican water carriers have made sure of that by consistently blocking such common-sense reforms as universal background checks and red flag laws. The differing outcomes that result are sobering. On that same day that Ireland was rocked to its core by 4 stabbings, more than 100 Americans nationwide likely died by the gun, based on daily average statistics. The American victims on Thanksgiving Day, the same day the Irish stabbings occurred, included a 16-year-old boy found dead in an SUV in Cahokia Heights, Illinois. Other fatal shootings that day were logged in or around Indianapolis, Milwaukee, Chicago, Los Angeles, and elsewhere. None of it spawned global or even national news coverage, let alone riots, because we're used to it. Ponder that dichotomy, and then ponder the gun culture trope that guns don't kill, people kill. The plain falsity of that trope is evident, not just in these tragic anecdotes, but in the data itself. In the U.S., which has by far the loosest gun laws in the advanced world, and by far the most guns per person, also has by far the highest gun mortality, both in total numbers and per capita. Every year, about 40,000 Americans die from firearms, homicides, suicides, or accidents. That's a rate of about 12 per 100,000, according to data from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Ireland, with its strong restrictions on firearms, experiences well under 1 death per 100,000. Generally, it totals about 50 deaths per year. Yes, unfettered access to guns does kill people. And that is another view from the editorial staff at the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. And here's a local article from the state page. This is Biden channel insurers on Democrats' caucus cards. Dems can express preference for long shot candidates. And this is written by Aaron Murphy of the Globe Gazette Des Moines Bureau. Iowa Democrats will have the opportunity in the state's 2024 presidential caucuses to express their preference for either of 2 long shot candidates challenging incumbent President Joe Biden. The Iowa Democratic Party's Leadership Committee, during its meeting on Saturday, approved a plan to include former Minnesota U.S. Representative Dean Phillips and author Marianne Williamson, in addition to Biden, on the formerly first-in-the-nation caucuses by mail presidential preference cards. Iowa Democrats scrapped their long-standing system of in-person caucuses for presidential preference and instead, for the first time in 2024, will gauge grassroots support for presidential candidates by selections marked on a card that will be conducted via the U.S. mail. The reform was an attempt by Iowa Democrats to address criticism of their complicated caucus system and maintain their leadoff spot in the quadrennial process of selecting U.S. presidents. While that effort failed, the National Democratic Party opted nonetheless to reorder its candidate nominating calendar and removed Iowa from the early voting window. Iowa Democrats have proceeded with their new caucus format. Instead of gathering in school gymnasiums and organizing supporters in huddles, Iowa Democrats will simply nominate a presidential candidate via mailed preference cards. The state party at Saturday's meeting determined which candidates would appear on the cards. There had been some question whether the cards would include anyone other than Biden, since he is an incumbent president and the party's unofficial leader. With Saturday's action, the Iowa Democratic caucus cards will include Biden, Phillips, Williamson, and an option to remain uncommitted to a candidate. There was no discussion about the candidate list during Saturday morning's meeting. When the list was made official, Iowa Democratic Party Chairwoman Rita Hart issued a statement saying she plans to caucus for Biden. Quote, President Biden has done more in his first 2 years than some presidents have done in two terms, and I believe he will win our 2024 Iowa caucuses, she said in the statement. Incumbent presidents rarely face serious challenges from within their political party during their reelection campaigns, and no incumbent president has ever lost a primary challenge. Biden finished fourth in the 2020 Iowa Democratic caucuses before going on in other states to earn the party's nomination and win that year's general presidential election. Biden finished fifth in the 2008 Iowa Democratic caucuses, which were won by Barack Obama, who then selected Biden as his running mate. Biden served as vice president for both of Obama's two terms in the White House. The Iowa Republican caucuses remain first in the nation in 2024. The Iowa Republican caucuses are also scheduled for January 15, which will be the first official step in the party's nomination of a challenger to presumably face Biden in the 2024 presidential election. In our next story, Iowa Bank faces class action lawsuit over crippling fees. And this is from Clark Kaufman of the Iowa Capital Dispatch. An Iowa bank is facing a potential class action lawsuit, claiming it has charged crippling overdraft fees to its customers' accounts. The lawsuit, filed in U.S. District Court for the Southern District of Iowa, challenges Bankers Trust's alleged practice of charging overdraft fees on debit card transactions that have been authorized by the bank itself due to the availability of sufficient funds in the customers' accounts. The lawsuit centers on the controversial use of fees applied to so-called Authorized Positive Settle Negative Transactions, or APSN. The alleged practice works this way. The moment a purchase is made from a merchant using a debit card, the bank immediately reduces the customer's checking account balance by the amount of that purchase. The bank also sets aside the full dollar amount of the purchase, holding that money in reserve for the merchant. However, the bank will then impose a $33 overdraft fee on the transaction if, days later, when the bank forwards the reserved funds to the merchant, the customer's funds are now depleted and the account shows a negative balance. Essentially, the overdraft fee isn't simply applied to transactions for which there are no funds. It's imposed on transactions for which the bank is actually holding a customer's cash in reserve to ensure payment. The lawsuit alleges these crippling overdraft fees are unwarranted because a customer's balance is always adjusted in real time to account for every debit card transaction at the precise instant the transaction is made. Quote, indeed, the lawsuit alleges, the entire purpose of the immediate debit and hold of positive funds is to ensure that there are enough funds in the account to pay the transaction, unquote. The lawsuit alleges that while many banks and credit unions, quote, that employ this abusive practice require their account holders to expressly agree to it when they open an account, Bankers Trust never did. Bankers Trust, the lawsuit claims, was fully aware that its customers believed they could not be assessed overdraft fees for debit card purchases, given that the funds needed to cover those purchases were instantly set aside by the bank and held in reserve to ensure payment. Quote, besides being deceptive, unfair, and unconscionable, these practices breach contract promises made to customers, the lawsuit claims. Quote, in breach of these promises, Bankers Trust assesses the $33 overdraft fees when there is enough money in the account to cover the transaction, unquote. The plaintiff in the case Stephanie Jones of Iowa, was allegedly assessed overdraft fees of $33 each on November 18, 2022 and May 8, 2023. Those fees were imposed on debit card transactions that had been authorized by Bankers Trust due to the availability of sufficient funds in Jones' account, the lawsuit claims. The fees were not imposed in error, but were intentional charges made in accordance with Bankers Trust written policies and routine practices related to APSN fees, the petition states. As part of the lawsuit, lawyers for Jones note that in 2021, the largest financial institutions in America charged customers almost $11 billion in overdraft fees. Customers who carried an average balance of less than $350 reportedly paid 84% of those fees. While some banks, including Bank of America, Capital One, Wells Fargo, and others, have taken steps to eliminate such fees, some have not. The lawsuit claims Bankers Trust continues to assess overdraft fees on APSN transactions, and that the bank, quote, has made substantial revenue to the tune of tens of millions of dollars, seeking to turn its customers' financial struggles into revenue, unquote. Moving on to obituaries in today's Globe Gazette. Dateline Brit. Thomas V. Zrostlik, that's Zrostlik, age 82 of Brit, passed away Saturday, December 2nd at his home. Funeral Mass, Saturday, December 9th at St. Wenceslaus Catholic Church in Duncan at 10:30 a.m. Visitation, Friday, December 8th at the church from 4 to 7 p.m. With the Knights of Columbus Rosary at 3:30, followed by a scriptural wake service. Leonard Pistek Jr., age 68, of Brit, passed away Friday, December 1, at the Hancock County Health Systems in Brit. Massive Christian burial, Wednesday, December 6th, 10:30 a.m., St. Patrick's Catholic Church in Brit. Burial, St. John's Catholic Cemetery in Duncan. Visitation, today, Tuesday, December 5, at St. Patrick's Catholic Church in Brit. Rosary, let's see, visitation from 5 to 7. Rosary begins at 4:30, scriptural wake following visitation at 7. Visitation will continue 1 hour prior to the services at the church on Wednesday. Gloria Trivette Johnson, age 81, from Mason City, Iowa, passed away November 30th. A celebration of life will be held on January 12th next year. Larry E. Hahn, age 82, of Clear Lake, passed away Friday, December 1, at his home with his family by his side. Memorial service, Saturday, December 9, at the Clear Lake United Methodist Church in Clear Lake, at 11 o'clock. Private interment will follow the luncheon at Memorial Park Cemetery in Mason City. Saturday, there will be a visitation from 9:30 to 10:30 at the church. And Gordon Lynn Wyman, age 78, of Clear Lake, passed away Thursday, November 30, at the Heritage Care Center in Mason City. Visitation, Friday, December 15, at the Ward Van Slyke Colonial Chapel in Clear Lake, and it will take place from 5 to 7 p.m. there. Funeral service, Saturday, December 16, 1:30 p.m., First Reformed Church in Missouri, and a celebration of life will continue at the VFW in Clear Lake, from 5 to 7 p.m. with fellowship and dancing. You are listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped. I'm your reader, Mary Frances, and all material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of people with print disabilities. Now we'll switch over to the Fort Dodge Messenger for Tuesday, December 5. Front page, we have three major stories. The first one taking up most of the room is Help from Our Friends. Webster County Conservation salutes local volunteers. Next one, no charges filed in dog attack. And the third one, Stratford Food Center rebuilding its stock. So we'll start with the dog attack from Kelby Wingert of the Messenger. No charges will be filed against the owner of three dogs that attacked a Fort Dodge woman on November 24, according to Webster County Attorney Darren Driscoll. According to a statement from Driscoll, the investigation following the vicious attack revealed nothing to, quote, indicate that any criminal act occurred, unquote. The woman was inside the home of the dog owner, alone with the animals, when she was attacked, he said. This is a shocking tragedy, and we wish the victim strength as she recuperates from her injuries, Driscoll said. Fort Dodge police officers were dispatched to the 800 block of South 16th Street at about 11:25 a.m., November 24, after a Webster County 911 dispatcher received a call from an individual stating they could hear someone yelling for help. A responding officer arrived and found a woman being attacked by three dogs, and after unsuccessfully trying to scare the dogs off, the officer shot all three dogs multiple times to stop the attack. The woman, who has not been publicly identified by authorities, sustained serious injuries and was airlifted to Iowa Methodist Medical Center in Des Moines after first being treated at Unity Point Health Trinity Regional Medical Center. Next story, help from our friends. Webster County Conservation salutes local volunteers. Then there are a number of photos of people sitting in a gathering, of people being recognized during the Friends of Webster County Conservation's annual business meeting at Camp Wanoke. This is from Hans Madsen of the Messenger. Webster County Conservation summed up the work that the Friends of Webster County Conservation does with a paraphrase of a line from a Beatles song that was on proud display during the Friends annual business meeting Monday night in the lodge at Camp Wanoke. We get by with a little help from our friends. Many of those friends and others were also recognized for the many hours they put into Webster County Conservation's various properties during the meeting. Trail Tech Brody Bertram highlighted some of the groups and individuals, including a group of goats that was loaned to them by the Peace Creek Animal Sanctuary that helped remove invasive species from the Children's Forest at the John F. Kennedy Memorial Park. Quote, they were there from July to October, Bertram said. We put some weight on them. They helped manage the invasive species that choke out the native ecosystem. Humboldt Vet Clinic helped transport them, and Franklin County Conservation loaned us the fence. They grazed 3 acres. That's 16,335 square feet per goat. As a thank you, the Friends group donated $300 to the Peace Creek Animal Sanctuary, which is near Badger. Another effort, with a lot of volunteers, was impressive by the numbers. This was the annual Des Moines River cleanup. We had 23 volunteers, 5 staff, and 15 boats, Bertram said. We pulled out 1 ton of metal, 72 tires, 1 ton of trash, 2 TV sets, and 3 of the heaviest microwaves ever to be lifted. I didn't know you could get that much sediment in one of those. We also pulled out 1 giant tractor tire. We also have the Johnson Jaguars 4-H Club, Bertram said. They come out and mulch the playscape area. Coles employees, workers from Cargill, Elanco, Fort Dodge Ford, Lincoln Toyota, and St. Edmund Catholic Church, or school rather, were also recognized for their help with planting and donating trees, as well as cleanups. Nancy Hamilton of Fort Dodge was recognized too. She's been stocking the free library in the John F. Kennedy Memorial Park campground for years. We work closely with the Community Foundation, she said. Webster County Conservation Director Matt Cosgrove gave the group an update on the River's Edge Discovery Center. He presented images of some of the exhibits and the current advanced state of construction that he said is ahead of schedule. One interesting item will greet visitors. We're going to hang a canoe built by Clark Fletcher's dad upside down with lights in it, Cosgrove said. He also gave an update on the Fort Dodge to Badger Trail project. Work is currently underway on the 10-foot-wide concrete trail. He's happy to report as well that he's been in talks with Hamilton County to possibly connect the Fort Dodge-Webster County Trail System to the Three Rivers Trail System in the future. Cosgrove also shared plans, some preliminary plans, for trails in both Gowrie and Dayton that are under development. The first phase of those trails in Dayton would circle the golf course and rodeo grounds. The Gowrie Trail would connect the golf course and school on the northwest side of town. Cosgrove is grateful for the work that the Friends Group does, as well as the funding they help provide. "We would not be able to do the things we do without our volunteers," he said. Casey Johnson, owner of the Fort Dodge Ford Lincoln Toyota, was on hand for the evening. "I came here in respect for all that you do," he said. "Quality of life is important for businesses that want a neat community to live in. This is one of the things that contributes to that. From the bottom of my heart, I thank you." And the third story from the front page, Stratford Food Center rebuilding its stock. After months of struggle, the grocery store's shelves are starting to fill up again. This is from Lori Berglund of The Messenger. It's no secret around Stratford that the shelves of the local grocery store have been a bit on the bare side these past few months. A combination of circumstances made stocking the shelves challenging, but the little store on the corner of Shakespeare Avenue is on its way back and in the hands of a new local manager. "We're slowly working to get everything filled," said April Carlson, who took the reins as manager a little more than 2 months ago. "It's a slow process, but I think we'll do it." What the Stratford Food Center needs now are customers to help drive the revenues that will enable the store to provide an even greater selection to local customers. "It can be a vicious cycle," Carlson said. "You've got to have customers and you have to have product on the shelf, but we can't buy it if we don't have money coming in to buy it." The trouble started with mechanical breakdowns over the summer, and then, as so many businesses are experiencing, a labor shortage making it difficult to hire a new manager. "This summer we had a lot of breakdowns in our freezers, and we lost a lot of product," Carlson said. Carlson has served on the board of directors of the Stratford Food Center for several years, and so she was up to date on the different challenges as they piled up. Turnover in the manager's position was only making things more difficult, so that's when Carlson decided to step in herself. "I knew we were struggling to find someone, and I also knew that a lot of people in the community really wanted us to hire someone that they knew, someone from the community," she said. Carlson grew up in the area and already had a job in Boone, where she had worked for 30 years. Still, she felt like it was time to make a change and take on a new opportunity to be of service to her community. "I just felt like this is where I needed to be," she said. The Stratford Food Center was a cooperative venture of community members when it opened about 20 years ago. Residents wanted a local option for basic groceries without requiring people to drive at least 20 miles to a larger grocery store elsewhere. For elderly residents who may no longer drive or prefer not to drive out of town, the Stratford Food Center fills a critical need. "The store is really important to a lot of people," Carlson said. "And it's more than your basic groceries. The store also has a kitchen, which provides a number of home-cooked meals to Athens Woods Estates each weekday. Carry-out meals are always also available to the general public from 11 to 1 p.m., Monday through Friday. The taco salad meal is a favorite among local residents, according to Carlson. But there are many choices that are listed each week on the Stratford Food Center's Facebook page. Typical hot meals range from country fried steak, French dip sandwiches, pork chops, and much more. In addition, Chester's Fried Chicken, available anytime by calling in advance, is another popular menu item for the store. As the Stratford Food Center builds back up its grocery selection, it is also increasing its cooperation with the Dayton Grocery Store. The two locally owned stores have long shared trucks and worked together, but they're now building on that cooperative venture, according to Carlson. "We're looking at sharing produce," she said. "That would reduce spoilage and give our customers more to choose from." The two stores are also looking at making joint alcohol purchases. There's a minimum order of $1,000 on alcohol, so if we can share that, it would help us both, she said. The Stratford Food Center has long offered local wines, as well as beer and other adult beverages. For Carlson, working each day in her hometown is a rewarding experience. I enjoy people asking questions and hearing their input, she said. I always try to listen to their ideas. We're happy to order things in that they request, but we also want to make sure that it's something that a lot of shoppers would enjoy, so it doesn't go to spoilage faster. Carlson is grateful for the level of community support and invites new people to check out the grocery store and make a point of shopping locally first whenever possible. We do have a lot of support from the community, she said. There was a fundraiser that really helped us. That spaghetti dinner fundraiser was held at the Stratford School in November and sponsored jointly by the Stratford Lions Club and Stratford Community Development Corp. We're making progress, she said. Now we're looking for a new board member to replace me since I took over as the manager. The Stratford Food Center has more than 100 stockholders who invested to make the store a reality nearly two decades ago. The next annual meeting of the group will be in February, at which time a new board member to replace Carlson will be elected. Other board members currently include Bill Cholley, Megan Cholley, Garrett Ament, and Chase Haman. Now we'll turn to obituaries. Nancy A. Stoner, age 94, of Lawrence, passed away Friday, December 1st at the Lawrence Care Center in Lawrence. Funeral service, Friday, December 8th at the Powers Funeral Home, Sacred Heart Chapel in Lawrence. That will take place at 11 a.m. Friday. Visitation, also Friday from 10 to 11 a.m. at the church. Marguerite Owen of Rockwell City, age 97, died Thursday, November 30, at her home. No services are planned at this time. William Bill Keenan, age 81, of Fort Dodge, passed away December 1 at the Paula J. Baber Hospice Home. Private family services will be held at a later date. Ann Nichols of Humboldt, age 75, passed away December 3rd. Memorial graveside services to be held at a later date in Harlan. Roxy Jacobson, age 81, of Fort Dodge, passed away Saturday, December 2nd at Mary Greeley Medical Center in Ames. Funeral services, Friday, December 8th at the Laufersweiler Funeral Home at 10:30 a.m. Burial will follow at the North Lawn Cemetery. Visitation will be Thursday, December 7, from 5 to 7 at the funeral home. Sandra K. Kaler, age 77, of Fort Dodge, died at the Trinity Regional Medical Center, December 3rd. Funeral services, Thursday, December 7, at the Gunderson Funeral Chapel, at 1:30. Interment will take place at the North Lawn Cemetery. Visitation, Wednesday at the Gunderson Funeral Home and Cremation from 4 to 6. And Kyle Hilbert, age 13, of Hardy, Iowa, died from the results of an automobile accident Wednesday, December 22nd. Funeral will be Saturday, December 9 at 10 a.m. at the First Covenant Church in Fort Dodge. Burial will follow at the Indian Mound Cemetery in rural Humboldt. Visitation will take place Friday, December 8th at the Gunderson Funeral Home in Fort Dodge from 4 to 7 p.m. And I'll read a little bit more about him. Kyle Scott Lewis Hilbert, the son of Sarah Moore and Anthony Hilbert, was born February 10, 2010 in Fort Dodge, currently a seventh grader at the Humboldt Middle School. He was active in Taekwondo and loved the outdoors. He loved camping and stayovers with his grandpa and grandma. He believed in giving hugs to his family, friends, and anyone that he met. Kyle loved spending time with family, playing video games, and going to the Renaissance Fair. And Sharon Blomker of Humboldt passed away December 1, Our graveside service will be held Wednesday, December 6th at the Union Cemetery at 2 p.m. with visitation will be prior at Mason Lindhart from noon to 2 p.m. Now we'll take a look at sports from the Fort Dodge Messenger. Big photo here of Fort Dodge's Mackenzie McElrath putting up a shot against Des Moines Hoover Monday in the Dodgers gym. The title is In a Zone, Fort Dodge 60, Des Moines Hoover 17. And just as an aside, I live about half a mile from Hoover High School here in Des Moines, and I can tell you, their sports programs are not strong. Dodgers work out kinks in home victory. This is from John McBride. The Fort Dodge girls rebounded from the first loss of the season with a convincing 60-17 win over winless Des Moines Hoover at the Dodger Gym Monday night. The Dodgers were coming off a 31-30 loss to Ames at home Friday, but they put three players in double figures and were never really challenged by the Huskies, who are 0-4. LJ Mayhel, that's M-A-E-H-L, led the Dodgers with 15 points. Mackenzie McElrath added 12, and Maya McCaleb chipped in with 10. It was a good win, said Fort Dodge head coach Scott Messerly. We told the girls there were some things we needed to shore up. We had pretty good balance in our rebounding. I saw some good things last night, but I think we'll know more about ourselves going forward, starting Tuesday night at Des Moines Lincoln. The two teams were ragged to start the game, continuing to miss their first 12 shots of the opening quarter. Fort Dodge finally found its rhythm and led 11-0 before Hoover finally scored with 2 minutes 30 seconds left in the opening period. Hoover missed its first 9 shots, and though the Dodgers were just 5-for-19 in the quarter, they led 14-3 after the first period. We were kind of playing like we were still thinking about that loss early on, said Messerly. We were missing free throws and missing some layups, but then we kind of came around. Hoover has scored more than 20 points just once in 4 games. The Huskies were held to just 4 of 37 shooting. That's just 11%. But I hate to play teams like this because they just keep throwing it up, and if they start making them, they can score in a hurry. I just wanted to play well all the way through the game, which we did, said Messerly. Fort Dodge was 22 of 55 from the floor. The Dodgers were 6 of 17 for 3. The Dodgers made it a 35-point game on a basket by McCaleb 2 minutes into the second half, and it was a continuous clock from that point on. Fort Dodge played all 11 of its available players. Junior Ashlyn Wills missed the game with an illness. Dakota Palmer added 9 points for the Dodgers, Brooklyn Palmer scored 7, and Janelle Long scored 5 off the bench. We're really young for the most part, but we've got a lot of good things from a lot of girls, said Messerly. Janelle Long made her free throws, hit some jump shots, and had 4 or 5 rebounds. It's things like that which will help us a ton. Monday's game started a 3-game week for the Dodgers. They're at Des Moines Lincoln tonight and then travel to Waterloo East on Friday. And keeping it local, the Fort Dodge bowling teams picked up 3 victories and a pair of triangulars on Monday at the Family Bowling Center. The Dodger girls beat Urbandale and Des Moines Hoover. The Fort Dodge boys beat Hoover and lost to Urbandale. We're looking for consistency, said Fort Dodge head coach Nick Vinson. We had a team meeting before and talked about that, and we can't go big and then small or vice versa. We have to be in the same range. Amira Lumsden led the Dodger girls with a 347 series. She had games of 160 and 187. Callie Graves also topped the 300 mark at 308. Also bowling for the Dodgers was Sol Berkey with 264, Bailey Wilson with 251, Samantha Anderson with 225, and Samantha Welter with 205. On the boys' side, in his first varsity action, Slade Babb had the high individual game with 254. The Dodgers are back in action on Friday when they host OABCIG, and that's all the time we have for today's reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette and Fort Dodge Messenger. I'm your reader, Mary Frances. Thanks for listening to Iris.
Roxanne Watson is on a mission.
Hello, how are you doing today?
She wants more people to register as organ, eye, and tissue donors.
Are you an organ donor?
Yes, I am.
Yay!
My goal is to sign up the most people in the United States.
What drives her? Roxanne's own life was saved through the gift of a heart transplant, made possible by an organ donor.
I decided that day that I was going to devote myself to the cause of organ donation and signing people up and honoring my donor by doing that.
Now she's back to health, and she's a powerful force helping to save lives every day through her work. Imagine what you can make possible by leaving behind the gift of life.
8 people can be helped with the major organs, and up to 50 people can be helped with a little bit of everything. And when you think about it that way, that you could help that many people, it's amazing, it really is.
Learn more and sign up as an organ, eye, and tissue donor. Go to organdonor.gov. A message from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Health Resources and Services Administration.